Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by Boston University Center for the Humanities titled Giving the Country Something New and Unknown, Reading Modernism's Literary History in James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. Our speaker is Yale University Professor Jacqueline Goldsby. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor Jean Jarrett, Chair of the English Department at Boston University.
Jackie Goldsby earned her BA from Berkeley and her PhD from Yale. Aside from her current professorship at Yale, she's previously taught at UChicago and NYU. At UChicago in 2003, she began directing a digital archive project that she recently completed called Mapping the Stacks, a guide to Black Chicago's hidden archives. Mapping the Stacks helped provide the staffing and funding to make more accessible the Chicago-based archives about mid-20th century African-American life. Goldsby's archival project laid the groundwork for UNCAP, an acronym for Uncovering New Chicago Archives Project, which widens and enhances access to finding aids for the archival collections at academic and cultural institutions in Chicago. Mapping the Stacks, finally, inspired the development of a national program administered by the Council on Library and Information Resources and funded by the Andrew Mellon Foundation. The national program similarly makes accessible hidden archival collections, and nearly $20 million in funds have so far been granted to institutions across the country. And by the way, in addition to this wonderful work, recovering archives, Jackie is a supreme literary and cultural analyst, and an award-winning one at that. Her first book, A Spectacular Secret, Lynching in American Life and Literature, published by UChicago Press in 2006, draws attention to the ways that the life of lynching happened to be unchecked in American society and under-interrogated in American cultural criticism. She argues that a particular congruence exists between literary narrations of lynching and the modern emergence of America at the outset of the 20th century. Subtle and trenchant, the study is replete with implications. She derives the cultural logic of lynching, or its systemic and phenomenal nature in national culture. She limns the historical contingencies of lynching on the events and symbols of national progress, and thereby critiques the scholarly tendency to cast lynching mainly as an exclusive feature of regional provincialisms and as an example of the mythical eternity of racism. And she extrapolates American history from the close reading of literary texts written by Ida B. Wells Barnett, Stephen Crane, and James Weldon Johnson. Further nuances of A Spectacular Secret almost defy paraphrase, and you simply have to go find a copy and read the book. And I say almost defy paraphrase because the MLA Scarborough Prize Committee had to write something superlative when it gave Jackie the 2007 award for publishing that year the best book in African American literature and culture, as had the American Studies Association, which named A Spectacular Secret a 2007 finalist for its Laura Romero First Book Prize. Currently, Goldsby is writing a second book, Birth of the Cool, African-American Literary Culture of the 1940s and 50s, that will examine the aesthetic cosmopolitanism of African-American literature during the post-World War II, pre-Civil Rights Movement era, and the new geographies of Black literary production during those decades. She's also editing a Norton critical edition of James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, whose forthcoming publication hopes to align with the centenary of the novel's original publication in 1912. Her talk today about reading modernism's literary history in Johnson's novel, I assume, will correspond to her preparation of that volume. Well, it's a painful death to be talked to death, so without further delay, let's please extend a warm welcome to Professor Jackie Goldsby.
Thank you so much, Jean, for that very generous welcome and introduction, and thank you all for attending my talk today. The students enrolled in creative literature and writing at Fisk University during spring term 1932 must have been thrilled and intimidated by the topic for their 17th meeting. That day, their professor, James Weldon Johnson, announced they would study narrative point of view in three texts, the autobiography of Bienvenuto Cellini, Robinson Crusoe, and Johnson's own novel, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. None of these works employed the most common styles of narration, Johnson explained, wherein a character in the story becomes the narrator, or by which the author assumes omniscience and omnipresence. Instead, these works developed a different model of focalization. In Cellini, Crusoe, and Ex-Colored Man, to abbreviate the titles, the author becomes the narrator, Johnson declared, and his discussion outline suggests that the class would probe how this dynamic structured the texts. But if he followed his lessons plan's talking points, Johnson took care to underscore how far-reaching this technique proved to be in literary history's broad scheme. So far as I know, he proposed, the autobiography of an ex-colored man is the only piece of fiction of Negro life written according to this method. With the prospect of hearing a living novelist, indeed their own professor, explain this creative strategy to them, these Fisk undergraduates surely had a seminar worth writing home about. Even if Johnson didn't teach it, the autobiography of an ex-colored man would have been on his students' minds because the novel enjoyed a lavish and extensive publicity campaign when it was republished in 1927 by the emerging powerhouse firm of Alfred A. Knopf. Handsomely illustrated by the renowned African-American painter Aaron Douglas, the Knopf edition mirrored Johnson's towering celebrity. Dating back to the 1890s and early 1900s, Johnson enjoyed a successful run as a song lyricist and poet. His musical fame took first root in 1901 when he and his brother Rosamond composed Lift Every Voice and Sing, then and now, commonly known as the Negro National Anthem. The Johnson brothers' name became even more well known once they teamed with Bob Cole to form Johnson Brothers and Cole. The trio's tunes and scores for the Broadway stage stayed in constant demand, as did the companion sheet music, which sold by the hundreds of thousands. Between their commissions and royalties, the group ranked amongst the most lucratively paid composers on Tin Pan Alley at the start of the 20th century, earning mammon with his music, a prospect that would have positively curdled W.B. Du Bois's nerves, but never rankled Johnson's, allowed Johnson to pursue poetry writing without worrying about his financial survival. In 1913, he published 50 Years and Other Poems, which garnered major notice in the New York Times, an achievement eclipsed by his later, and many consider, his masterwork, God's Trombones, published in 1927, in which Johnson's adeptness at writing dialect exquisitely renders the image, mood, and music of African-American sermons into verse form. A longtime political activist, Johnson's post as field and then executive secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People placed him in the spotlight as he led that organization's anti-lynching crusade for two solid decades. Absorbed by this work, NAACP colleagues described Johnson as obsessed with it. I've explained why that was the case in A Spectacular Secret. But Johnson kept active and visible in the worlds of arts and letters in two ingenious ways, compiling anthologies and mentoring rising literary stars. The Book of American Negro Poetry and the Book of American Negro Spirituals were recognized as field-defining works when they were first published in 1922 and 1925, respectively. And young, new Negro authors like Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Claude McKay, and County Cullen, amongst others, owe much to Johnson for leveraging his formidable cultural capital to secure writing fellowships and publishing contracts that fostered their careers. I retrace Johnson's pathfinding ways not to illustrate why his teaching assignment at Fisk was so remarkable, though it does bear mentioning, too, that his academic appointment made Johnson the first African-American to hold an endowed chair at a U.S. university. Rather, I cited to remind us that Johnson was long involved in edge-cutting artistic and political movements of his time, that experimentation and innovation were not unusual pursuits for him. Johnson's visionary outlook is important to remember because beneath the glamour of these firsts lies the occlusions literary history is prone to produce and Johnson's place in those shadows. For being the first to develop a new mode or form of making art was not and is not easy, and recognition of those creative labors is hard-earned, if they ever come at all. Or as Johnson put this point in one of his most famous poems, O Black and Unknown Bards, from 1908, what merely living clod, what captive thing, could up toward God through all its darkness grope, and find within its deadened heart to sing these songs of sorrow, love, and faith and hope? How did it catch that subtle undertone, that note in music not heard with the ears? How sound the elusive reed so seldom blown, which stirs the soul or melts the hearts to tears? That subtle undertone, that note in music not heard with the ears, the elusive reed so seldom blown, Johnson's commitment to experimentation is why we also need to remember that the aura of fame that suffused the 1927 edition of the Autobiography of the Next Colored Man and preceded Johnson into his Fisk classroom did not characterize the novel's initial publication 15 years earlier. In 1912, the Autobiography of the Next Colored Man emerged with little print publicity. As you can see in this photograph, the book object was visually unremarkable and kind of nondescript. Indeed, it pales in comparison to the vividly imagined and symbolically enriched canvas invented by Aaron Douglas. This difference between the novel's physical form between 1912 and 1927 marks a rupture which I believe, and will argue today, James Weldon Johnson sought to explore and explain to himself by teaching his novel at Fisk. When he announced to his class that X Colored Man broke new ground in its implotment of point of view, I don't believe he was using the seminar to boast of this accomplishment. Rather, Johnson used that opportunity, along with another course he taught at Fisk, a survey of contemporary American literature, to think through and theorize what he had accomplished, formally speaking, with his novel's first appearance on the literary scene in 1912. What does it mean, though, that it took him 20 years to reckon with his early work this way? My talk today approaches X Colored Man from this rear view, so to speak. In the absence of robust and inclusive discussions of modern fiction that regarded African-American literature as a serious contributor to fiction writing's aesthetic developments, it's no wonder that Johnson grappled for terms to understand X Colored Man's formal and cultural impact. Indeed, writing his novel and later historicizing it required vocabularies and strategies that Johnson couldn't have named in advance, given how tenuous the literary field was for black novel writers and novel writing in the first decades of the 20th century. In 1932, though, Johnson and his Fisk students took their measure of X Colored Man's place in and across its times. From the vantage point I hope to create for us today, we can judge for ourselves how long-lasting X Colored Man's modernism proves to be. For those of you who are unfamiliar with it, the Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man reads as the Bildungsroman that its title suggests. Born in Georgia a few years after the close of the Civil War, we're told, the narrator is the child of the unsanctioned love between a prosperous white Southern businessman and an African-American woman. The home of his boyhood soon changes to Connecticut, where, supported by a stipend from his wealthy father, added to by his mother's earnings as a seamstress, the narrator enjoys a comfortable upbringing. However, his social security depends upon two crucial presumptions, that he is rich and he is white. This early idyll ends when the narrator learns his actual racial identity. At school, he's asked to segregate himself from his white classmates because his teachers know his mother is black. Orphaned and uncertain about his identity, the narrator begins a tumultuous journey that comprises the core of the novel. Migrating up and down America's southeastern coast, his ambiguous racial appearance allows him to masquerade or pass for black or white at will. He mixes and mingles among African-American college students in Atlanta, Cuban refugee nationalists in Jacksonville, Florida, and gamblers, nightclub musicians, and jet-setters of all racial and ethnic backgrounds in Manhattan. A musical prodigy, the narrator's piano playing talents lead him into the world of ragtime music, where he quickly wins fans among the cabaret crowds and financial backing from a moody millionaire who sponsors the narrator's travels abroad to Europe. Performing at his patrons' parties in London, Berlin, and Paris, the narrator gains a reputation for ragging the classics, adapting classical music into ragtime piano's signature sounds and cadence. However, when a German pianist performs black folk music to sound classical itself, the narrator decides to adopt this method as his own and returns to the U.S. to pursue his career as a black folk musician. The novel's climax occurs with the grim destruction of the narrator's plan. While conducting fieldwork in Georgia to collect Negro spirituals, the narrator witnesses a brutal lynching of a black man. This horrific event spurs him to make a startling decision. In his words, "I would neither disclaim the black race nor claim the white race, but I would change my name, raise a mustache, and let the world take me for what it would." The novel then concludes with the Pyrrhic victories which follow in the wake of the narrator's decision to renounce his black identity and pass for white permanently. Emulating his white male role models, he becomes a businessman like his Southern father and aims to earn millions like his former musical patron by dealing real estate in New York City. Under the guises of wealth and whiteness, the narrator meets and falls in love with a white woman. Their courtship thrives until the narrator gambles with the truth and divulges his biracial identity to his fiancée. At first, the woman breaks off their engagement. She relents and marries him, though their union comes at a high price. She dies giving birth to the couple's second child. Left to raise their children on his own, bereft and confused about his life's purpose, the narrator admits to himself and to the reader, "When I sometimes open a little box in which I still keep my fast yellowing manuscripts," his sheet music compositions he's referring to, "the only tangible remnants of a vanished dream, a dead ambition, a sacrificed talent, I cannot repress the thought that after all, I have chosen the lesser part, that I have sold my birthright for a mess of pottage." To call this story an autobiography was a heretical act on Johnson's part, given the legacy of that genre in African American literature. Before 1912, autobiography was the predominant genre in black letters in two distinct phases. Prior to the Civil War, black life writing was vigorously promoted by the anti-slavery movement, which sponsored fugitive slaves lectures and published print editions of those talks as part of its campaign for black emancipation. I'm sure you know those works well, by Frederick Douglass, William Wells Brown, William and Ellen Craft, Henry Box Brown, Jerina Lee, and Harriet Jacobs, to name the often taught texts. After 1865, African-American autobiographies were directed toward a black readership and their publication controlled by black-owned printing firms to meet new political needs. The rise of Jim Crow segregation laws, the re-exploitation of black laborers under the sharecropping and convict lease systems in the South, the political disfranchisement of the Southern black electorate, and the rise of lynching and rape as means to terrorize black communities to comply with these new forms of white supremacy gave fresh purpose and meaning to African-American autobiography during the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and early 1900s. Freed women and freed men needed role models whose courageous, exemplary conduct could inspire them to persevere and uplift the race, as the motto went, despite the repression raging against them. The black periodical press routinely featured these profiles in its pages, but two book-length memoirs towered above them all, which I'm also sure you know. Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, published in 1901, and W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folks in 1903. Ex-Colored Man's preface unsettles yet another prescriptive practice that defined African-American autobiography before World War I. At a first glance, the 1912 edition appears to rehearse the anti-slavery movement's tactic of offering white-authored testimony to guarantee the black-authored narrative is legitimate. And indeed, the publishers of Ex-Colored Man offer fulsome endorsement of the work. However, no one at Sherman & French Company, Johnson's 1912 publisher here in Boston, wrote the copy. Johnson's correspondence confirms that he composed the preface to the 1912 edition. Digital culture has taught us not to fixate on attributing authorship to its original creators. Ours is a time of cut-and-paste collaboration where the circulation of ideas trumps the attribution of their origins. In 1912, during the violently segregated time in which Johnson lived and wrote, composing his own copy for the preface leveraged an astonishing critique of the literary politics that governed black autobiography during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Given its multiple iterations of forgery, Johnson composed the statement on behalf of his publisher, pretending to be the anonymous ex-colored man who is the book's supposed author. The preface decidedly rejects the idea of embodied authenticity that slave narratives promoted, to embrace instead artifice as the principle of truth-telling in black fiction writing. Johnson's ambition to test that limit explains his boldest revisions of autobiography's framing devices. He opted not to title the novel The Chameleon, suggested by his brother and songwriting partner Rosamond. Rejecting a phrase that explicitly identifies the text as a fictive work, Johnson clearly wanted to trope on the construct of autobiography and so dislodge the racial politics that had become embedded in the genre's form. Operating beyond African Americans' autobiographies' then known boundaries, Ex-Colored Man could and did unsettle key thematic norms of that tradition. Antebellum narratives placed a premium on depicting arduous physical experience, namely the brutalities meted out during the enslavement and the terrors and challenges to escape to freedom. Consequently, descriptions of black bodies abound in fugitive slave narratives as writing surfaces upon which the story of racism's degradations can be made legible. These corporeal focused accounts were often entwined with a companion plot, the narrator's journey toward attaining literacy. Since under U.S. slavery, literacy was forbidden, suffering to read and write were depicted as profoundly moral and indeed spiritual acts in antebellum autobiographies. However, literacy and its signature tropes, like corporeality's value as a sign of autobiographical authenticity, come under critical revision in Ex-Colored Man. Growing up in liberal New England, funded by his white father's wealth, the Ex-Colored Man didn't have to steal his education, but his relationship to literacy begs for close analysis, given the ways he flaunts his access to and skill at reading. Despite his abundant allusions to books and boasts about his superior skills at comprehension, the narrator schemes to use reading to avoid social responsibility. Perhaps the most scandalous instance of this outlook occurs when the narrator lives and works in Jacksonville, Florida, as a lector, reading Spanish novels and newspapers to the Cuban factory laborers that make cigars. The narrator readily accepts the post, not just for its cultural prestige. The lector, he tells us, must have a reputation among the men for intelligence, for being well-adjusted, and having in his head a stock of varied information, but also for absolving himself from the bodily toil and economic hardships faced by his fellow workers. Quote, "My position as a reader not only released me from the rather monotonous work of rolling cigars, it gave me something more in accordance with my tastes. It also added to my income. I was now earning about $25 a week." The crass selfishness that animates the Ex-Colored Man's recollection simply refuses the moral imperatives that energize scenes of reading and education in slave narratives and postbellum autobiographies, like Up from Slavery and Souls. In this regard, the novel's most heretical challenge to black autobiography took shape in Johnson's anti-heroic depiction of the narrator. The Ex-Colored Man bears little, if any, resemblance to the fugitive slave autobiographers like Douglas or Jacobs, let alone postbellum authors like Du Bois, Washington, or the other masterminds of the race, as they were called, whose life stories were widely read and known by black reading publics. Critics look to explain the Ex-Colored Man's rebelliousness as evidence of an Africanist spirit or his trickster sensibility. But that argument doesn't quite do justice to the delight the narrator takes in flouting the rules of racial respectability as they're defined by black communities. Moreover, he relishes describing those lapses. How, for instance, are readers to regard his jilting the schoolteacher who he all but promised he'd marry in Jacksonville? His carousing through New York City's Tenderloin District borders on scandal, a descent the Ex-Colored Man narrates not to thrill the reader, but to savor his own amusement at his exploits. Such carelessness leads him to flee situations others might risk their lives to protest, that critics have debated his reaction to the lynching he leaves. He watches, but he leaves. He doesn't try to intervene. He doesn't try to stop. Critics have debated this for over 20 years in the scholarship, and that suggests to me just how unexpected his response remains. Because his political commitments are so weak-willed, readers have to wonder if the narrator's invocation of Du Bois' concept of double consciousness, then, is truly heartfelt or a display of self-pity. That, though, is the novel's disquieting point and force, to call the very idea of racial solidarity into question. For this reason, the Ex-Colored Man's name, such as it is, Ex-Colored Man, negates the racial self that autobiography interpolates as a literary type. Indeed, the Ex-Colored Man's ever-shifting decisions to pass for black or white at any given moment destabilizes the validity of racial categories as such. These moments, which the lynching scene crystallizes, unbind the process that autobiography reifies, that race, together with the forms of cultural expression that emerge from it, consists of behaviors and practices that can be observed, learned, and performed at will, including the rejection of its most cherished literary forms. African-American autobiography's experimental genealogy, ranging from Zora Neale Hurston's Dust Tracks on a Road to James Baldwin's No Name on the Street, Audre Lorde's Zamie, and Adrienne Kennedy's People Who Led to My Plays, could be fruitfully traced back to Johnson's project, except that the autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man is, in fact, a novel. And yet, before he taught the book at Fisk, Johnson rarely called his work by its proper literary name. He referred to it as a work, the book, and a human document in his correspondence. Only when he planned and drafted Ex-Colored Man from 1906 to 1912 did Johnson describe the narrative as a novel. Why was this the case? What does its resistance to its rightful generic name tell us about Ex-Colored Man's modernizing force? Johnson's confusion about Ex-Colored Man's unclassifiability placed him at the cutting edge of literary history because his work of art was more than that. It was a text whose resistance to obvious categorization made it modern. or as literary theorist Roland Barthes would explain this distinction, works become texts, and texts are modern when they, quote, cannot be contained in a hierarchy, even in a simple division of genres. What constitutes the text is, on the contrary, or precisely, its subversive force in respect of old categories, close quote. However, critical accounts of Afromodernism do not cite Ex Color Man as a founding text, and I have to say that was really kind of stunning to me. This occlusion occurs, I think, because we misattribute the 1927 edition as the historically significant text when, in fact, the earlier publication revolutionized African-American novel writing when it was first released in 1912. For instance, the Ex-Colored Man's nomadic journeys along the eastern seaboard abroad to Europe and in varied urban centers on both continents make migration and urbanization central nodes of action for the novel's plot. In the wake of Cain and Quicksand, Ex-Colored Man's cityscapes aren't new. In 1912, Johnson's descriptions of these terrains evoke another world, remote, spectral, phantasmagoric. This, to the narrator, is Manhattan and its totem of freedom, the Statue of Liberty. New York City is the most fatally fascinating thing in America. She sits like a great white witch at the gate of the country, showing her alluring white face and hiding her crooked hands and her feet under the folds of her white garments, constantly enticing from within, thousands from within, and tempting those who come from across the seas to go no farther. All these become the victims of her caprice. Some she at once crushes beneath her cruel feet, others she condemns to a fate like that of galley slaves. A few she favors and fondles, riding them high on the bubbles of fortune. Then, with a sudden breath, she blows the bubble out and laughs mockingly as she watches them fall. When not terrifying, national space becomes fluid, inchoate, permeable. Georgia melds into Connecticut, Connecticut into Georgia, Georgia into Florida, Florida into New York. Or put another way, place becomes a state of mind in Johnson's novel. It is, in short, and as the passage I just read suggests, an objective correlative. So that the cityscape of Manhattan that we encounter through the Ex-Colored Man's eyes presages but reads nothing like D.C. and Chicago and Cain, Chicago and Harlem and Quicksand, or, for that matter, the Chicago of Richard Wright's Native Son, the Harlem of Ellison's Invisible Man, the Greenwich Village of Baldwin's Another Country, or the Los Angeles of Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. Just as the geographies of black migration and city life modernized the novel's social interests, so does the soundscape of early 20th century America. Ex-Colored Man can and has been read by musicologists as a primer on the emergence of ragtime music into early 20th century American culture, not least because the Ex-Colored Man boasts that he's a leading figure in that new musical movement, and musicologists have verified that the practices he refers to, the kinds of social spaces where the music was performed, are accurate. And indeed, the modernity of ragtime style, its skipping staccato-paced tempo, its intricately woven chord structures, its movement across America's largest urban centers, it moved from New Orleans to Chicago to New York, and its celebration of prodigal talents and geniuses, which might explain the Ex-Colored Man's egotism in some sense, infuses the novel with such precise allusions to the U.S. culture industry that literary critics now debate how hierarchies of taste, the fate of black popular culture, and the rise of intellectual property rights under commodity and now information age capitalism define the novel's key concerns. The targeted formalist point I want to make, however, concerns the textuality of sound. Now, the novel's tone has always been its most studied and admired formal innovation. Upon its initial release in 1912, reviewers in the popular press consistently praised the narrator's cool reserve. For instance, the Portland Maine Express found the narrator's dispassionate self-analysis absorbing, while the Chicago Record Herald enthusiastically applauded the work's unbiased discussion of the Negro problem. Scholars call this restraint irony and applaud it for the analytic leverage it provides the narrator's observations. However, the fugue tones of the narrator's voice create their own surface that rubs against the bright bang clash, thank you, Leroy Jones, pace of ragtime sound. Consider this passage where the Ex-Colored Man recounts his first piano recital for his patron, the millionaire. The man's powers of endurance and listening often exceeded mine in performing, yet I'm not sure that he was always listening. At times I became so oppressed with fatigue and sleepiness that it almost took superhuman effort to keep my fingers going. In fact, I believe I sometimes did so while dozing. During such moments, this man sitting there so mysteriously silent, almost hid in a cloud of heavy-scented smoke, filled me with a sort of unearthly terror. He seemed to be some grim, mute, but relentless tyrant, possessing over me a supernatural power which he used to drive me mercilessly to exhaustion. But these feelings came very rarely. Besides, he paid me so liberally, I could forget much. In this performance, the millionaire looms villainously, a grim, mute, relentless tyrant, provoking unearthly terror in the narrator victim. Indeed, this scene suggests that slavery has not ended. Likening artistic production and patronage to a kind of bondage, the narrator suggests that exploitation lies at the core of making modern art, a charge this sobering complaint seems to affirm. However, the reader's identification stops short with the passage's final line. To learn that the narrator very rarely felt oppressed and that his salary bribed him into forgetting much mars the reader's mounting concern because of that flat yet upturned mood. The narrator sounds insouciant. Why push us away from empathizing with his plight? The threat described here stems not only from the millionaire's predatory listening. It also follows from ex-colored man's manipulative speech and tone, which is to say, this novel must be heard and listened to as a condition of reading it as a print text. The cultural flux that music both embodies and activates, like the narrator's migrations across the country and around the world, find yet another source in the novel's theme of racial passing. As I discussed earlier, the ex-colored man's constant shifts across the color line demonstrates the fallibility of racial categories. Indeed, his adoption and adaptation of racial behaviors, acting black, then acting white, anticipated in 1912 what we now call a post-black sensibility. At the height of his songwriting success, Johnson began taking literature classes at Columbia University. Records of his courseworks aren't in his archives, but he does write movingly about his studies with Brander Matthews, who, as a proponent of Anglophone literary nationalism, an author of the earliest American literature survey textbooks dating back to 1896, and an early president of the Modern Language Association, that place we all know, revere, and love, he was in a prime position to introduce Johnson to a broad band of reading. Indeed, since Matthews claimed he offered the first class in the modern novel in an American university as early as 1891, it's entirely possible that Johnson took that course. But during the years Johnson was enrolled at Columbia, off and on between 1900 and 1906, the status of American literature and contemporary fiction in English departments was embattled. British literature and philology studies long dominated undergraduate curricula, while rising tensions between generalist critics and research scholars over the proper approach to teaching literary texts led to quarrels about over-specialization, which in turn intensified the already heated debates that American materials were necessarily too specific and lacked historical gravitas to justify their place in a liberal arts curriculum. Contemporary literature couldn't win for losing, coming under fire from both ends of the generalist scholar ramparts. As historian Gerald Graff tells us in his Institutional History, Professing Literature, quote, most professors distrusted both kinds of new fiction, popular entertainment literature for its superficiality, the more serious literature for its immorality, materialism, and pessimism, close quote. If during the early years of the 20th century, academic interest in the literature of the present or recent past was at best hesitant and sporadic, as Graff points out, it shouldn't surprise us that Johnson floundered about too. Energized by the books he got to read and discussions he was able to have with instructors like Matthews, but lacking a clear vocabulary to describe how the modern literature he no doubt read functioned on the page. Nonetheless, Johnson wrote. He took a completed first draft of the novel's first manuscript with him to a plum political job he managed to land, thanks to his fame on the Broadway stage and Booker T. Washington pulling all the strings that he had in his hand. In 1906, he was appointed to serve as a U.S. consul for the State Department in Puerto Cabello, Venezuela. There, he told his best friend from college, an English major turned college professor, George Towns, that he intended to use his time abroad to devote himself to his literary work. Johnson writes, I have lots of leisure time for reading. I brought down about 50 selected books. It's an ideal sort of life for a man of any mental resources. Johnson's diary lists several of the 50 books he read. Among them were Henry James's What Maisie Knew, Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, and Thomas Hardy's Jew the Obscure. None of them were African-American books. Having finished reading Ex-Colored Man in preparation to create his 1927 Just Jacket, painter Aaron Douglas was awestruck by the novel. As he explained to Johnson, "I've just finished reading the book, and I'm carried away with amazement and admiration. Your depth of thought, breadth of vision, and subtlety and beauty of expression awakens in me the greatest admiration. I'm amazed at the gigantic effort which must have been necessary for the writing and publishing of the books at such an early date. The post-war Negro, blinded by the sudden glare and almost bursting of a new day, finds much difficulty in realizing the immense power and effort which the pre-war Negro has made to prepare the country for what we now feel to be the awakening." Douglas's note asserts a particularly acute historical observation about the aims Johnson's novel achieved, sought for and achieved. The pre-war edition required immense power and effort to put into print, creating the conditions for artistic innovation that the post-war Negro then assumed was entirely new. Looking at this image, we might then interpret Douglas drawing a slash of orange that cuts into the figure's face to form that man's line of sight. A diacritic-looking mark, it looks like a dash to me, thus links the practice of novel writing to the worlds of urban modernity, the skyscrapers and factories, and the pre-industrial past, the silhouetted ground, still life-giving, yielding tall, stalked flowers as a sign of nature's persistent growth. Notably, the male subject, perhaps here Johnson the novelist, is poised between these two realms. And notably, too, Johnson's name is now prominently displayed on the book's front cover. And thus, we have Johnson embodying, on the one hand, the midpoint between these two cultural histories and the ways in which their relationship to each other could be occluded. If ex-colored man's paradigm-shifting role in new Negro modernism has gone under-conceptualized by readers and scholars, the novel's paradigm-making contributions to Anglo-American modernism have been entirely overlooked. However, Douglas's comments make clear, as do Johnson's reading program in literary studies at Columbia, that the novel's interstitial place between literary eras suggests how those periods may be joined together. They are, I'd suggest, an instance of what Wei-Chi Dimmock calls backward extension, wherein the emergence of a literary form occurs in a doubled temporality, reaching backwards and forwards at once. Thinking of chronology not in linear but recursive terms, a novel like Ex-Colored Man can become, Dimmock would argue, and as I do here, again, remembering that Ralph Ellison got there before both of us, they can become literary kin to other kinds of work that we would not expect. Released from the restraints of meter and rhyme that writing poetry and song lyrics had instilled in him, the manuscript drafts of Ex-Colored Man read as Anglo-American and new Negro modernists like Langston Hughes espoused, spontaneously, without self-censure. So if we don't censor our reading, we can contemplate Ex-Colored Man's relation to a worldwide web of modernist novels published contemporaneously with and after it in 1912. And I'll quickly move through some here. For instance, Virginia Woolf's third novel, Jacob's Room, echoes Ex-Colored Man in several rich ways. First, the novel's protagonists and stories resemble each other almost exactly. Like the Ex-Colored Man, Jacob Flanders is a young man in search of himself and his vocation. A handsome, intelligent aesthete, Jacob aspires to be a writer-critic, not unlike the ex-colored man who tries to become a world-renowned musician. Each man's dream gets cut short by history. Jacob is summoned from his comfortable bourgeois life in Georgian England to fight and die in World War I. The ex-colored man's migrations away from the safety of his New England home during America's Gilded Age leads him to the lynching in Georgia's backwoods, where he experiences his social death. In life, Jacob's aloofness recalls the ex-colored man's detachment as both men live in Wolf's world, well, she's describing Jacob, in a gloom, this surrender to dark waters which lap us about. Sigmund Freud would call this condition melancholia, which Jacob suffers from deeply, silently, and ignorantly. The ex-colored man, by contrast, understands the funk that envelops him, and he uses writing, hence his autobiography, as one way to redress his pain. So the ex-colored man as a writing subject distinguishes him from Jacob, but in a lot of social points, they resonate with one another. These wounded, maimed men, the dead and walking dead, the modernist anti-hero gains expressive force in Ex-Colored Man and Jacob's Room because the novel's narrative experiments clarify each other's efforts across the decade that separates them in two ways. First, what critics have long argued about Jacob's Room provides a spot-on frame to analyze Ex-Colored Man's narrative innovation as well. Quote, "The form of the novel is the novel subject. As an alternative to the false reality of the biography of fact, the novel offers a biography of fragments, and this fragmented form mirrors the novel's attempt to draw together the pieces of a life unexpectedly torn apart. That's been said about Jacob's Room. That seems absolutely apropos for The Ex-Colored Man to me. Second, because both novels attempt to narrate their protagonist's lives from the inside out, we can discern more readily the great risk Johnson assumed with his project. Where Jacob's Room features multiple narrators recalling Jacob's life, Johnson's use of a single focalizing consciousness lays bare the technical difficulty, as he called it, involved in sustaining the reader's desire to inhabit a point of view that may be disagreeable to her own. I just don't like The Ex-Colored Man. I don't know about you. He's difficult to like. The Ex-Colored Man's untrustworthiness, then, links Johnson's novel to F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. The 1927 edition of Ex-Colored Man easily fools us into placing it behind Fitzgerald's most famous work, but the resonances between them raise the stakes of the novel's aesthetic and cultural politics when we recall Ex-Colored Man appeared more than a decade ahead of Gatsby. Read recursively, then, the historical arc of the Jazz Age extends from Long Island's East and West Eggs to the Manhattan Tenderloin neighborhood where Ex-Colored Man is largely set. Indeed, the club scene that The Ex-Colored Man's music creates draws the likes of Tom and Daisy Buchanan, Jay Gatsby, and Nick Carraway into the city like moths to the flame. That is to say, Johnson's novel foreshadows Gatsby's world of self-made elites, spectacular wealth-making schemes, and frenzied materialism. Here, the parties thrown by The Ex-Colored Man's millionaire patron are not foils but complements to the reckless soirees staged by Jay Gatsby. The novel's cultural commentaries demand and sustain readers' attention, though, because of the formal innovation that Johnson and Fitzgerald each deploy so shrewdly, unleashing an unreliable narrator to depict their novel's social worlds. Like The Ex-Colored Man, Nick Carraway is a detached observer of his social milieu. I was within and without, simultaneously enchanted and repelled by the inexhaustible variety of life, Nick remarks. Standing apart from the West and East Egg cultures, disdainful of wealth yet powerfully attracted to it, Nick's aloofness mirrors The Ex-Colored Man's, as does his ironic temperament echo his predecessor. Nick's reports of the conspicuous consumption and deceit he witnesses not only echo The Ex-Colored Man's ethnographic dispatches on the Freemasonry of the race — you might as well be getting a Freemasonry of the Lives of the Rich and Famous from Nick — they remind us that Nick gains access to this otherwise closed world by passing in and out of its domains at will, thanks to the cultural capital of his class credentials and his whiteness. His familial connection to Daisy and Tom Buchanan, together with the Ivy League education that lands him a job on Wall Street, function comparably to The Ex-Colored Man's racially ambiguous appearance. For that reason, we might be tempted to say Nick lives behind his own veil of double consciousness. However, because he shares The Ex-Colored Man's fantasy of self-contained mastery, both men resist acknowledging that his perspective might be deficient, blocked, or incomplete, restrictions that account for the smothering power of Du Bois's veil. Presenting themselves as a sole measure by which it's not only possible but desirable to know the worlds they inhabit, Nick's and The Ex-Colored Man's narratives offer totalizing visions that eclipse other points of view that might rival their perspectives and power. This arrogance makes them unreliable, and yet their will to dominate the text compels the reader's attention all the same. Hence, in both novels, the project and scene of writing are as much the novel's topic of concern as anything else. Narrated retrospectively, The Great Gatsby exposes the scenes of its constructedness as boldly as The Ex-Colored Man. First, Nick signals directly to the reader that he's in the midst of making a book. Reading over what I've written so far, I see I've given the impression that the events of three nights several weeks apart were all that absorbed me. On the contrary, they were merely casual events in a crowded summer, and until much later, they absorbed me infinitely less than my personal affairs. Besides alerting us that what we are reading has been fashioned for us, a passage like this alerts us that we can't trust the historical lineage the novel recounts. Time gets telescoped, Nick admits. Compressions occur by a sleight of hand. Distortion rather than reflection is what we ought to expect, this revelation suggests. Meta-narrative moments like these abound in Ex-Colored Man, too, where the novel draws attention to the narrator's note-taking and narrative-making. Johnson's own blind spots to his novel's possible kinship with texts like Wolfe's, Fitzgerald's, and Stein's explains why teaching Ex-Colored Man was a vital, creative step for him to take. The talking points Johnson prepared for his creative writing seminar indicate he'd only recently developed a clear-minded assessment of ex-colored man's place in literary history. In preparation for his teaching assignments at Fisk, Johnson undertook his own course of self-study, actually asking Joel Spingern at Columbia for books to read. And amongst them, he read all three volumes of V.L. Parrington's Maine Currents in American Thought, which came out in 1927, and E.M. Forrester's Aspects of the Novel, also published in 1927. Critical works like these proved invaluable to Johnson because they helped codify for him the shapes of American literature's developments over time and the place ex-colored man might claim in those schemes. Following Parrington's paradigm, Johnson organized his contemporary survey course, American Literature 1880 to 1930, by the genre rubrics of historical romance, realism, and naturalism. For the unit on modernism, Johnson turned to another guy because Parrington's literary genealogy stopped with realism and naturalism's wane around World War I. Here, E.M. Forrester's Aspects of the Novel clearly resonated with Johnson's understanding of fiction's formal developments, given how consistently he relied on Forrester's typologies in his lecture notes. Johnson meticulously planned class sessions to orbit around Forrester's definitions of the novel's aspects. His seminar notebook lays out queries and examples that distinguish between story and plot, illustrate the differences between flat and round characters, and track the oscillations that relate pattern to rhythm. More radically, Johnson's course design reflected Forrester's theory of periodizing modern novel writing as such, an approach that undoubtedly led Johnson to include his own novel on the seminar's syllabus. According to Forrester, the novel's literary history knows no national boundaries. Indeed, Aspects begins by decentering the hegemony of the British canon altogether. Quote, "An unpleasant and unpatriotic truth here has to be faced," Forrester admits. "The English novel is nowhere near as accomplished as the Russian or French novel. Before these triumphs, we must pause." Nor do temporal boundaries demarcate the novel's history, according to Forrester. Artistic progress isn't gauged solely through forward-leaning momentum. The 18th century's Tristram Shandy has much to teach students of the modern novel's history, so far as Forrester's concerned. Thus, he declares, quote, "This idea of a period of a development in time, with its consequent emphasis on influences in schools, happens to be exactly what I'm hoping to avoid during our brief survey. Time all the way through is to be our enemy." Rather, Forrester envisions the history of novel writing and its genealogy to be fundamentally communal, collective, and cooperative. And this is an important passage. "We are to visualize the English novelist not as flowing down that stream which bears its sons away unless they are careful, but as seated together in a room, a circular room, a sort of British museum reading room, all writing their novels simultaneously. They do not, as they sit there, think, 'I live under Queen Victoria, I under Anne, I carry on the tradition of Trollope, I am reacting against Aldous Huxley.' The fact that their pens are in their hands is far more vivid to them. They are half mesmerized, their sorrows and joys are pouring through their ink, they are approximated by the act of creation." Johnson had to have been inspired by this image and Forrester's claim precisely because American museums and libraries notoriously excluded African Americans from using their rooms and resources for such study. With the British canon's taste-shaping power de-emphasized in a set of lectures delivered at Cambridge University, no less, reading aspects of the novel, Johnson could see how his work counted in conversation with other texts, in conversations that drew from and contributed to a global literary practice. Moreover, Forrester's model of literary history reoriented the temporal horizon against which Johnson could evaluate his own work. If novel writing happened simultaneously in what Wyche Dimmock now calls deep time, then the autobiography of an ex-colored man could be read in the context of Johnson's contemporaries and those works that preceded their own. With the field of novel writing leveled and desegregated in this way, literary alliances, resemblances, and affinities, again, what novelist Ralph Ellison would later call literary kinships, could be claimed and asserted as first principles of understanding, not merely after the fact. In short, it wasn't too late for Johnson to claim the novel he first published in 1912 as a modern work in 1932. To conclude, that Johnson relied on Forster's argument to codify the autobiography of an ex-colored man's place in literary history doesn't mean he couldn't grasp the workings of his own novel's aspects. On the contrary, Johnson's turn to criticism like Forster's suggests how fervently he wanted to understand the formal and cultural breakthroughs he achieved writing Ex-Colored Man. Serving as his own literary historian proved to be a struggle for Johnson, though, not because he was overly modest to admit the importance of his effort. Johnson knew full well that he had written something bold, big, and new with his first and only novel. Indeed, anticipating Virginia Woolf's landmark manifesto, Modern Fiction, published in 1919, Johnson summoned, quote, the courage to say that what interested him was no longer this but that, writing a novel that so thoroughly transformed the depiction of the dark places of psychology that the American reading public was utterly confounded by Ex-Colored Man when it was first released in 1912. For Johnson to need 20 years to gain perspective on his novel's place in literary history by teaching it as a modern text to his students at Fisk underscores the importance of literary history and criticism to the work of creative writing itself, reminding us how each field makes the other possible. However, like the ex-colored man's white father, whose neglect causes his son great anguish, the literary histories we construct often remand black texts to a separate and unequal sphere of critical disregard. When James Weldon Johnson read aspects of the novel, he must have felt affirmed by the insurgent possibilities that Forster's theory of novel writing implied, because it opened the way for him, his students, and now us, to understand how the autobiography of an ex-colored man contributed to the history of modernism's future. Thanks.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Yale University Professor Jacqueline Goldsby. Professor Goldsby's lecture was titled Giving the Country Something New and Unknown, Reading Modernism's Literary History in James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, and was presented by Boston University's Center for the Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Professor Jean Jarrett, Chair of the English Department at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vigas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.